we weren't prepared for life on our own, and weren't prepared for celibacy. We were just, in a sense, given an academic education and thrown in at the deep end.
Now that I'm married myself and I have a family, and I look back on the kind of sermons I preached about marriage, like I shudder to think now the kind of things I said at that particular time.
I wouldn't be conscious of being the boss at all. There are some things for which you must take ultimate responsibility, and that can be a lonely, isolating experience.
Everybody wore the same uniform, the soutane, and you wouldn't appear out of your soutane for any reason except to play football. And through the day, the professors, everybody wore the same garb, and we would have been censured in some way or other if we were found out of our soutane for any particular reason.
A sense of humour was important, and I suppose in many ways the authority figures in the college were often the butt of jokes and the sense of, and maybe tricks to some extent. For instance, people who would want to or have an excuse to go out to Dublin, they might remove the screw from their glasses and go up and show the two separate pieces to the vice president in particular, because in a sense the president and vice president had this kind of hard cop, soft cop image you hear about nowadays, that the president was considered a tough kind of character and the vice president would do, he'd have been preyed on to some extent by the pupils, that the day that the president was away, people would go up to, with any kind of an excuse, and get out, partly because we felt maybe the vice president liked to show his authority and to let the birds fly while the president was away.
There was a lot of one-upmanship, like if you get one over on the authorities, it was almost like a game between you and them, you know, and if you could win an occasional joust, you know, you felt really chuffed. I have one memory of Frank O'Connor about 2 weeks before he died. I think he gave his final lecture in Maynooth, and he got a great reception. The way in which he was brought in, apparently, was that the Literary and Debating Society, or whichever group invited him in, went to the authorities and said they wanted to bring in Michael O'Donovan, which was his real name, in the sense Frank O'Connor being a pen name. So the authorities hadn't heard of any Michael O'Donovan with a bad reputation. So they allowed him in, and they couldn't do much about it then after that again, because they wouldn't like to admit that they didn't know that Frank O'Connor was a pen name. And that. So that, in a sense, was looked on as a victory for the students. But again, maybe a Pyrrhic victory, in that they'd make sure that wasn't going to happen the second time. I remember in particular the All-Ireland Final of 1964, a group of students, probably best part of 100 or more, all gathered outside the window of a professor who had the radio left out on the window sill. He was breaking the rules himself in that sense. And a couple of hundred students below the window listening to the football match, and among them one man who should have been playing in Croke Park. He had played in the All-Ireland semi-final, but he wasn't allowed out, so he was there just listening to the match, almost by accident or by the good graces of a professor who was kind enough to put the radio on the window.
In Maynooth at the time, there were 93 of us in the one year, in 1964. The names were drawn out of a hat, at least that's what we were told. For seniority, I was number 76, and I think Porrig was about number 57 or so, which meant that in terms of the allocation of rooms, that students at the lower end would have to double up and share rooms. There were a few double rooms because there would have been 535 students studying for priesthood at the time. I doubled with Porrig. When it came to picking the room, Porrig chose a room which we wouldn't have known at the time, the room beside the ghost room, and had the number of the ghost room in years gone by. It was the second room from the end of the corridor.
The first year, beside the ghost room, and what was called Rhetoric House, or still is, I'm sure. And I remember certain aspects of that, that, you know, you'd make sure you had been to the toilet before, so you wouldn't have to go out in the middle of the night. You know, you could be very bravado about the ghost room, but you'd be shuffling back along the corridor and maybe 2 or 3 in the morning in the dark, you'd be afraid of what you'd meet. But we were lucky in the sense that we had known each other and had been friends in secondary school. But there were two men, young men put into the room on the other side who hadn't known each other. And one of them apparently was a sleepwalker. And when his roommate woke up in the middle of the night, he discovered him walking around the room. And the story of the ghost apparently was, you know, a sad case the previous century, early in the previous century, when a man threw himself out the window, and something similar happened 20 years later. And because of that, the wall of the room was removed, and it was an oratory ever since. But when this student saw his fellow student walking around in the middle of the night and heading over towards the window, he thought this was happening all over again, you know. In the notes, cat was a slang term for caveat, the Latin word for warning. And it was considered a very severe warning because the third of them meant you were sacked, you had to go home, or you were finished as a trainee priest. So one was considered very serious, two extremely serious, and the third you were finished. In fact, very silly things tend to merit a cat in those times. In the past, it was, I think, people got them for what were considered very serious, I suppose, things like smoking and possibly drinking, reading novels. Sometimes people who were even studying literature wouldn't have been allowed to read novels. In our time, I know one classmate of ours got a cat for reading the Longford Leader, which wouldn't be considered very scurrilous, I'd imagine.
This was a tradition handed down by generations of students in Maynooth, that it was something very serious. If you got a solemn warning, which was known in popular parlance as a cat, then it may be an indication that you were not intended to become a priest. Well, there are a lot of lore built up around that, and yet we had heard stories of students from our own diocese of Tuam years and years ago who were found playing cards on one occasion. The card players were expelled, and some of them studied for a diocese in Scotland. And it is said that the bishop of that diocese wrote back to the president of Maynooth looking for more card players. They were among the finest priests that that bishop had in his diocese. At the time, it was common for students in a diocese to come from what was known as the minor seminary, in our case, St. Charlotte's College. We would have built up a good relationship with our classmates back in in St. Charlotte's over 5 years. And we felt that Christmas time might be a good time to have a little get together. It would be the only opportunity that we would have in Maynooth, because it wasn't possible to get out for gatherings of that kind. So one night there was a function in the Aula Maxima which some of us did not attend. We went to our rooms and we decided we'd try and organise a reunion of our 1964 Leaving Certificate class. One thing borrowed another. The other students returned from the function and close on 12 o'clock, which would have been time for solemn silence being in our own rooms in bed asleep, there was a knock on the door and the dean walked in and found a number of CHUM students sitting around the room. And we were marched back to our rooms. He told us that he would be sending for us the following morning and would be bringing us before the administrative council. The president, you must remember, was a CHUM priest, Monsignor Gerard Mitchell. The dean, on this occasion, it was said that he mischievously succeeded in getting the president quite irate. The president did not realise that the dean had been filling him in on the behaviour of CHUM students. So at that point, the president was quite embarrassed by the fact that it was CHUM students who were the culprits on this occasion. The president asked us to account for the fact that we had been brought before the council for breaking the two most serious rules in the college. One, the infringement of solemn silence, and the other, entering another student's room. One student said that we were organising a reunion of our own class back in St. Charlotte's, and you must remember that the president was a past pupil of St. Charlotte's. At that stage, the president said, "Surely you don't expect me to take that as a reason." And one student became eloquent at that stage and said, "Well, we're not offering it so much as a reason, but rather as an explanation." Now, needless to say, the president had no time for casuistry of that type. And he did let us know in very definite terms that we were in deep trouble. He would have to inform our archbishop and inform our parish priests.
This was a frightful experience at the time. And even though we were maybe thought we were hard men and rebellious, it still knocked a fair bit of the stuffing out of us. And I remember, like, our great fear was that the other students in our class and in the college would find this out. And one of the chaps had a brother there, and he was terrified that his brother, who was in his last year or so, would find out about this at the time. And I remember us begging the administrative council not to to divulge this to anybody that would receive these solemn warnings. And they were amused that we would have thought like that, that this was part of the punishment, that everybody should know about it.
The Archbishop at the time, Archbishop Joseph Walsh, was not very impressed by deans and by deans reporting students to him. And he did tend to make allowances for students who had difficulties with deans and with authorities in Maynooth. He never confronted us on the issue, which would probably be an indication that he didn't take it too seriously.
I remember sometime after that again, the same dean sweeping into the room in which the present Archbishop Michael Neary and myself, we were sharing that room that year, and he seemed to think he had scored a great triumph. I remember him drawing out my bed, and there was a newspaper under the bed, and it was the Sunday Times, which I had taken from outside the door of a professor who lived near us, just to read. But lucky enough, the professor's name was on top of the page,
And we had been studying Greek, and he was a professor of Greek. So at that stage, the dean pulled in his horns a bit and kind of accepted. Nothing was said, but he didn't push the matter any further. It was quite common for dean to tell students at the time that there were vacancies in the bank and in the guards, and there seemed to be continual pressure to get people to leave. Or at the time, there would have been. Was probably the highest level that vocations or students studying for the priesthood was at in Ireland, and there seemed to be a concerted effort to weed us out, and quite often the feeling was that it was the flowers that were being weeded and then the weeds that were left, and I include myself among the weeds, you know, that people with spark or with idealism or with kind of lively, exciting people seemed to have been targeted, and it was like as if there was an effort to bring about uniformity, and that, you know, if you were cute enough to keep your head down and not break any law or rule, you know, you get through all right, you know, but if you showed any initiative or any, that you'd be targeted or certainly taken down the size, if not driven out altogether, you know. But I've met some people over the years who were quite bitter because they felt they were hounded out. They were hounded out. They were very enthusiastic and very idealistic people, and it left them quite bitter because it was really maybe a personality clash with the dean rather than anything to do with their capabilities. Psychological or any other way of being good priests.
The dean at the of discipline at the time, at the end of that particular year, he was saying that he didn't know what was coming over the students, that he had administered more cats in that particular year than he had in the rest of his 20 years in existence as dean there.
There were too many given out at the time, so suddenly warnings, or these severe warnings, became somewhat of a joke, and ever after that, they never seemed to have the same effect. But things were changing in Maynooth as well, because the following year was the first year that lay students came in. And in a sense, that was the watershed year, the year that it went from being virtually a monastery to being an open university.
Like, quite a number of students over that particular period were beginning to look at what was happening in other colleges. So one of the things that we were demanding at the time was this establishment of a Students' Representative Council. And I remember there was quite an amount of resistance to this. And the college authorities at the time said that they couldn't allow this to happen without it going to the Bishops' Conference. And they were going to meet at Easter. And I think there was such a fear at the time that this Students' Representative Council wouldn't be established that the students threatened that they were actually going to go on strike. And some reporter got wind of this, and I remember the evening paper's headline at the time, "Students Put Gun to Bishop's Head." This was quite a headline at that particular time for seminarians to be going on like this. At that particular time, I think the Irish Church was ripe for development, and of course it was just after the Second Vatican Council as well. But we went through a minute of great change, like when the introduction of lay students became a reality as well, and students from other orders and nuns also started to study in Maynooth, and that made a lot of, I think, a very big contribution to our own development. I remember there was quite a number of Divine Word missionaries. It was, I think, good to study beside people who were going to the missions, and to discuss with them the kind of fears and worries and expectations and challenges and all that they saw ahead of them. Like, one of the other significant events at the time was the introduction of the daily newspapers into the college. We weren't allowed to have the Sunday papers for some reason or other, but we could actually read the daily newspapers, and there was a reading room where these were introduced. I remember there was such panic on the first day that they were introduced, because the dean had distributed the newspapers in the reading room and left them there, so that the students coming back after lunch break could see them, but some student who had skipped lunch or the prayer after lunch had gone into the reading room to do some reading and discovered all those newspapers that he didn't expect to see there and took the whole lot in case the dean had found them. The dean marched down with all the students to show off the newspapers and found all the papers had disappeared. So there was a bit of pandemonium on that occasion. But the other thing that, of course, came in our time minute was television was introduced to the college as well. And as Solemn Silence disappeared, it was replaced by watching television programmes. I remember programmes like Kojak and Hawaii 5-0 and stuff like that was on the go at the time. And this was, a kind of a rare novelty for the students at that particular time, because having gone through secondary school and into Maynooth, like we didn't, even though television was becoming a feature of many homes, we wouldn't have had the opportunity to see that much television. So that it was something that at the particular time that, just like now with the problem you'd have in your own home trying to get children to study, the competition with television, and it was something that competed a bit for our time as well, and one had to develop some discipline about that. Like, and that was the difference between our early years in Maynooth and the latter years. Like that, in the early years we were told virtually what to do every minute of the day, and in our last two or three years there, it became much more a situation where you could make up your own mind on things.
There would have been great hopes even then. The issue which tormented the church for 30 years afterwards, for instance, contraception, it would have been known then that the commission set up by Pope Paul VI had recommended that there be change, whereas the following year then Humana Vitae came out and it was scuppered. In many ways, the theological staff would have been split down the middle at the time. There'd be arch conservatives and some quite liberal people, and some people who seemed to jump on the bandwagon whichever way it turned. The number of people who had been making liberal noises up until then, but as soon as when Rome spoke, they jumped on that particular bandwagon and were rewarded for it in positions of power and authority.
I think in the last few years that I would have spent in the priesthood, I was gradually coming to a conclusion that the particular life wasn't for me, that I wanted something different. It was quite a number of reasons that I was... that were coming up in my mind why I should leave at the particular time. I remember something that happened accidentally, where I had gone to see a psychologist to get some counselling help for somebody that was looking for that, and that was kind of rare enough at that particular time, and to even get it around Castlebar was probably unique as well. But in listening to the psychologist talking about the kind of work that he normally did and the kind of work that he would be doing with the people who needed the help I went for, I felt that maybe a few chats with him myself would clear my own thoughts, and I found that very helpful, and in helping me to make up my mind about what I wanted to do, because I always felt like that I had drifted into the priesthood without giving it a lot of thought. Like it would have been almost traditional expectation within my family scene that I would have gone this particular road, and from the day I could talk, like it was something that was mentioned to me, that this was that I was I was going to be a priest, and nothing else was ever considered. And I remember the year I did the leaving cert, saying to my mother that I was thinking about looking at agricultural science and going into that particular area. I remember very clearly what she said to me, and that she had virtually almost visions from God that this was the route I should think about. Like, and I remember my father was working in England at the time. His main purpose in being there would have been to make it possible for me to go through secondary school and on to Maynooth, because in Maynooth at that particular time, there wasn't a lot of financial assistance from the diocese. Like, by the time you got to your last 3 or 4 years, the amount of help you'd have got from your bishop would have been a bit more substantial. But for any family that didn't have a lot of means, putting through a student through Maynooth at that particular time was quite difficult. And I would have felt all those kind of pressures, like, that I just had to keep stay with it. And I suppose, like, one felt like, you know, that this was going to be quite a good life anyway. And you saw priests having what was considered maybe the good life. They mightn't all agree with that, but that was the kind of conclusion I came to anyway, that I had drifted in, and I didn't want to go through a drift situation and maybe drift out an alcoholic in 10 years later or something like that. I left then in 1979. I had actually went to work in England, got a job over there as a social worker, and worked over there for a number of years. It was quite a difficult decision to make. Like, I suppose people who go through marriage breakdown and have to make decisions to split up, you know, go through the same kind of process, and there is a certain bereavement attached to it, because there's quite a loss in your life. Like, there was certain guilted I found attached to leaving. Like, did you feel you were letting people down? That would have been one of the things that I was able to discuss with the psychologist at the time that I went to see, and I found that very helpful. Like, in, you know, that if this decision had to be made, well, it was my life and my decision, and I couldn't be worrying excessively about who I was going to let down. Like, and particularly, you know, like, you'd be concerned about your own family situation. My mother was alive at the time, like, and like, I did realise that it was a very hard knock for her. Like, it was difficult in a small rural townland in the west of Ireland for a mother to experience her son leaving the priesthood. I think that she herself got a lot of support locally that she didn't expect to get, just as I also got from a lot of people. Like, I was quite surprised at the number of people who wrote to me and wished me well, people from the parish that I had been in. Both my family and the bishop at the time were quite helpful, and like, if I had fallen hard times financially, I'm quite sure and certain, like, that the bishop at the time wouldn't have seen me left in any kind of difficulty.
Revelations of child sexual abuse in recent years, I suppose, have been the saddest and the most difficult thing for priests to deal with. I suppose watching States of Fear and some of these other documentaries, you know, I've been trying to think back, was I aware of anything of this going on? I remember as students from Maynooth in the later years, we used to go down to Dangan Reformatory on a Sunday evening, and, you know, there'd be maybe a football match or a concert or something, and when I saw some of these programmes and realised, you know, what was going on, and it came as a shock to me to have been there, and you know, it brought home the reality, I suppose, more so, or to have seen some of the people who have on television who were traumatised by this, you know, to realise that it was the institution, you know, to which I belong, and to which I've given my life, that were, you know, closed their eyes to some extent, or that this, that, you know, the good people that were in these places also, in positions of, you know, as priests, brothers, nuns, and various things, that, I suppose the saddest thing is that they didn't speak out, and at the same time, having come through the system, I suppose, I can I can understand the almost impossibility it was for some of them to speak out if they wanted to remain in the orders that, in which they were. So it's very traumatic to think back that you know, I belong to the system that allowed this to happen.
I was amazed. I was absolutely dumbfounded by them. I did not have any idea that such things were happening. And I would not be alone in expressing that view, because most of the priests with whom I would speak would have been equally both horrified and totally dumbfounded by hearing these things said about, well, about colleagues who are priests, but also in society itself. There was a total lack of awareness on our part. You expect vulnerability to be respected, but when it's not just not respected, but rather when it's exploited, well, then I think it's very difficult to find words to give expression to the sense of outrage that one experiences. As a priest or a bishop, you belong to a family. You have nieces and nephews. And very often you put yourself in that situation where one of those may be abused, and you're just a very short step away from a very angry reaction then. I believe that the Lord is saying something to us through the scandals, through the different things that are happening in our society, different developments that are taking place. And these are being presented as challenges. I feel that if we're going to respond to these challenges, then we must be in there convinced of the contribution which Christ has made and continues to make to human society. For example, in the church in Tuam, I believe that there is now a greater involvement of lay people, much greater participation. For example, when I was ordained a priest in 1971, women were not reading in our churches at the time. I remember at my first Mass, it was two uncles who read the epistles. I have three sisters. I didn't have any brothers, so I recall that very clearly.
The future has to be different, because the present situation won't continue. The vocations and all that has shown, proven the facts and figures are there to show that things can't and won't go on as they are. So, you know, the future has to be different, and in that sense, it's exciting for whoever will be around. And, you know, the decisions that have been postponed in this century will have to be made in the next century, say, even though things like women priests or married priests and many other aspects of the church, minor enough aspects in a sense. I think, for instance, women priests would be far more important from the point of view of equality, and there'd be danger of being introduced for the wrong reasons, for, you know, lack of vocations rather than for people's women's rights. But I think all these things will
have to be faced up to by the next generation. But you know, we will get through the millennium first, and in the old-fashioned way. And I think from then things might begin to take off.
We would have met for the first time when we did the entrance examination for St. Charlotte's in June of 1959. And that friendship would have continued into Maynooth. And while we have our separate responsibilities since then, and while we may not be meeting at very regular intervals, I find no difficulty in taking up from where we left off with Porrig. It's a relationship that has, I suppose, transcended the kind of responsibilities which we have, which each of us would have at this time. And I have never experienced our responsibilities to come in the way of our relationship.
Yes, yes, boss.
I think that the ability to be able to laugh at oneself is very important. And it's important to be able to laugh at oneself before anybody else laughs at you. And this is something that I would have learned in Maynooth, and it's probably something I would have learned from my classmates from the diocese in Maynooth, and to which or to whom I would be eternally indebted. I enjoy a good game of football, and I like to see Gaelic football being played as it should be played, in a sporting, clean, competitive, skillful way. I suppose that would be part of my background in St. Charlotte's. Not that I was any good at the game, but I was very keenly interested, and still am. It's difficult on Sundays when you're heading off to confirmations, and maybe your county team or some other team that you'd like to see is involved in a game. But the call of duty demands that you follow the gospel.
I would still value something like the attendance of Mass on Sunday, for example. I would give a certain importance to that. On a fairly regular basis. Sometimes I'd often wonder, you know, is it the children bringing you to Mass, or are you bringing them to Mass? But I do feel it's an area that I haven't, that I would miss that contribution of my life into my life if I was to abandon it or anything like that. I would feel like, you know, that a number of priests who left, like, you know, left entirely, left the church completely behind them, and wouldn't have any contact of that kind. But I think for the majority of ex-priests, like, they do have a continuing involvement, and some more than others. Some make quite a contribution in their own, to their own church where they live and work. But I think, like, it's a question that's often asked of myself, like, with the shortage of priests that are there, would you go back again? But I always felt this was a particular vocation that I went into, and that wasn't for me. And I don't know at this stage of my life would I think any differently either. I think I'd probably still hold with the same line, that I shouldn't have ever went in that particular direction.
I'd probably describe myself now as a lapsed radical sort of thing. I've gone old and tired and not willing to buck too many trends anymore. You know, but at the same time, I've, you know, probably to writing, and more than anything, I have tried to, you know, carve out in the sense of almost a career, parallel career, but also very church oriented in many ways. You know, that it's a way of asking questions for which you cannot be wrapped very much in the knuckles. You know, I suppose it's to some extent an imitation of the Jesus' own methods of telling a story and letting the story hang there rather than trying to say to somebody, well, this is the way it should be, or this is the way it is. You know, just he or she was ears to hear, let them hear, rather than laying down any particular line that people get their own meaning from things. As for staying in there, I just don't know. Maybe St. Peter's answer when Christ said, will you two go away? You know, to whom shall we go? Sort of. For me, this was what I wanted to give my life to. And it still is.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.